dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A battle space in that war that is mostly ignored, I'm sorry to say, by altogether too many of us, is the arguably most important element of our national security of all, namely our ability to deter aggressors armed with nuclear weapons from threatening us, or worse, using them to attack us. A woman who has given a great deal of thought to that subject, fortunately, and who we're always delighted to have with us here at Secure Freedom Radio, is Dr. Michaela Dodge. She is these days a research scholar at the National Institute for Public Policy. She formerly served on the staff of then-Senator John Kyle as his senior defense policy advisor. She also graced the Heritage Foundation for a number of years, bringing with her great expertise about deterrence and what it requires in a changing, indeed, an ever more dangerous world. Michaela Dodge, it is so good to have you with us. I wanted to say, first of all, congratulations on the publication of an important new paper about intercontinental range ballistic missiles, or ICBMs, and their importance for allied assurances and security. And I want to talk with you a bit about that. But first, again, it's good to have you with us. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. Happy New Year, and thanks for having me back.
It's great to do so. Let me talk, first of all, about ICBMs and their unique characteristics and why the kinds of threats we're facing today really require us to remain armed with such weaponry.
So our ICBMs are part of a nuclear triad, and they bring attributes that no other leg of the nuclear triad, as we say, brings, the other two being submarines and bombers. For one, you cannot destroy ICBMs with conventional weapons on the U.S. territory, and so they really, really complicate your adversary's targeting problem. For two, they're very prompt, which might be important in some scenarios in which the United States is under attack. They're extremely survivable, and they're important for U.S. allies.
So these attributes have historically been seen as not only unique, but vital to having a credible deterrent posture. There is some talk, and we'll discuss more about this in the next block, but just to put it on the table, of the arms control community, which expects to have considerable influence with the incoming Biden administration, that these weapons can be dispensed with. And I want to ask you first, before we get into why that's ill-advised, to talk about the kinds of threats that we now see emanating most especially from China and Russia, and how those unique features of ICBMs really relate to our ability to contend with the growing dangers from those quarters.
Absolutely. So, you know, China is planning, or is reportedly planning, on doubling the size of its nuclear arsenal in the future in the next 10 years, which that's not that long of a time frame, given how long these systems take to field and develop for the United States. Russia is developing and deploying a whole host of new strategic nuclear weapons that are not a part of any arms control framework. Russia also has advantage in tactical nuclear weapons. And so, you know, the idea that under these circumstances where our adversaries are increasing and diversifying their nuclear portfolios, we go down to nuclear dyad and rely on day-to-day on, day-to-day deterrence operation on MONAC, which would be the submarines, because our bombers usually do not carry nuclear weapons. I don't think that's a very wise policy at all.
But to stay with this issue of the threat, there's the quantitative improvement. And honestly, I'm not confident at all. We really know what the size of the Chinese nuclear arsenal is at the moment. As we've talked about before, Michaela Dodge, they've built 3,000 miles of hardened underground tunnels in which to hide much of their nuclear arsenal. It's unlikely we really have a fix on its size, but it seems incredible to me that it's just a couple of hundred warheads that one would go to those lengths to conceal. But whatever the number is, there's also the qualitative dynamic changes taking place in both the Russian and the Chinese nuclear arsenal, is there not? And to the extent that we may see weaponry coming into those arsenals that we don't even understand, let alone have adequate defenses against. That's another reason for not taking risks, is it not, in terms of, unilateral disarmament?
Absolutely. And I was going to bring this up in the second part of our conversation, but the Minuteman system has been or was deployed in the 60s and the 70s. It's a very old system, and I'm sure you remember debates about whether the system was survivable in 1980s, and the conclusion was that it was not, and hence we developed the MX Peacekeeper. Well, we don't have that ICBM today, but we still have Minuteman threes, despite our adversaries, as you were saying, having qualitative improvements or, pursuing different kinds of weapons that we cannot because we are under self-imposed policy restrictions. It's a really worrisome trend because during the Cold War, we issued these nuclear challenges to the Soviet Union, and the Soviets had to respond and they had to spend their resources that then couldn't be used in other ways. We have not been very competent in this area of strategic competition. And so our future modernization program, to the extent that we're modernizing our delivery systems, offers us that opportunity to issue a challenge to our potential adversaries and adversaries. And if we do not modernize and do not replace these aging systems, we're going to be worse off in the long run for a host of reasons, some of which we mentioned.
There's a lot there to unpack, and we'll do that on the other side of a short break. But I do want to just say, Michaela Dodge, that it's not just our delivery systems, that is to say, intercontinental range ballistic missiles, both land-based and sea-launched, and bomber forces are all roughly of that age. And it really speaks to the distinct disadvantage we now face in this very, very important portfolio. We'll talk more about the nature of this challenge and what we must do about it with Michaela Dodge of the National Institute for Public Policy. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're speaking for a second block with one of the country's most thoughtful experts on our nuclear deterrent posture and its serious shortcomings and what we need to do about it. And in this segment of our interview, we're going to talk with Michaela Dodge about all of that. And I'd like to start, Michaela, with the question to you of, are the warheads that are on our missiles and bombers any younger, any more modern, any more, shall we say, reliable than the systems that are designed to deliver them, which are quite aged, as we talked about before. And if there's any uncertainty about that, what does that mean for our deterrent? And what should we be doing about it?
So our nuclear warheads are certainly not any younger because we have not deployed a new nuclear warhead design since the late 1980s. We maintain them, and after we conduct what is called a life extension program, we reset their age to zero, and that's how we count the average age of our nuclear arsenal, which is really misleading when you think about it, because there is no way those weapons that were built and designed in the 60s, 70s, and 80s that you can just say, oh, they're brand new right now. And, you know, by the way, we're not putting forth the sort of the thinking capital to really assess and evaluate our military requirements going into the future. So we had military requirements that the warheads met during the Cold War. Are they the same military requirements that we need today when we're facing more nuclear adversaries with different types of active nuclear programs and given new technologies that come into play in sort of that relationship between conventional and nuclear weapons? That's a question way above my pay grade, but my sense is that we haven't given ourselves the full leeway to answer and think through these questions honestly. And as you know, part of the problem is that we are under self-imposed policy restrictions to not conduct any yield-producing experiments. So not even if these yield-producing experiments produced as little energy as when you drop a pencil, but if we had that kind of data, we would understand better, really, what is the type of uncertainty we're dealing with, what potential reliability issues we might have into the future, because it's just not available. We cannot get the data from computer programs and computer simulations because we have never had data from a nuclear arsenal that was as old as we have today.
Michaela, this is such a critical point, and unfortunately, you're one of the few in the nuclear weapons policy community that I know of who doesn't, you know, quail at the idea that we actually have to begin nuclear testing to address some of these problems that you're talking about. Michaela, this idea that we can go in and we can do a service life extension program on ancient, relatively speaking, ancient warhead designs that are, as you say, not actually what we would want for deterrence in today's environment in all likelihood. But we can swap out parts of those warheads and put new things in, new chemistry, new materials and the like, and just put it all back together again, and on the basis of simulations, assume that it's going to work. This is just, you wouldn't do that with your car, I don't think, let alone with something that the nation's security arguably depends critically upon, would you?
I cannot fully comment on sort of technical need to do that, but as a policymaker, what I want is to ensure that technical experts have the freedom and the backing of the government to explore the full range of opportunities to give us as certain answer as they can. My sense as a policymaker is that if we say you cannot test unless you have, you know, just extremely serious problem in one of your warheads, we are not giving them the freedom to really examine this issue closely. If we are telling them survey the stockpile and, you know, do sort of random sampling, it's a very different problem set than if we tell them, go and find mistakes in our warheads or go and find uncertainties in our warheads. And so that's what worries me, you know.
We're asking the wrong questions.
Right. It's not black and white, go and test tomorrow, but it's be confident that you can do that if you think that's the best way to go about maintaining our stockpile. And we both know that there are quite a few nuclear warhead designers, particularly those who actually design nuclear warheads, who will tell you that it's an essential component of maintaining the stockpile, that we cannot maintain our stockpile based on just computer simulation, that it's not sufficient, however successful that program has been in the past.
These are such important points. I'm afraid that there are fewer and fewer weapons designers still with us, simply because they've passed on in many cases. They've certainly, in I think virtually every case, left the Department of Energy's nuclear weapons laboratory complex. And the trouble with it not being something we're doing right away, to use your phrase, or at least as soon as we can, and by some estimates, Michaela, it's going to take us 3 years to conduct the next nuclear test, which is just outrageous, it seems to me. And maybe not even possible then, given the encroachment of Las Vegas on the nuclear test site. We have allowed to develop a degree of obsolescence at best, and at worst, you know, incredibility in our nuclear deterrent posture that I fear is only incentivizing our adversaries, who we believe have not only been incessantly modernizing both their delivery systems and their weaponry, and by the way, doing some nuclear testing to support all of that, to believe that, you know, they're obtaining decisive advantages over us, which is very, very alarming, needless to say. Which brings us to the Biden administration. As I said, Michaela, and we talked about a little bit, the arms control community seems to really be hot for this idea that we're going to get rid of the intercontinental range ballistic missiles, the ICBMs that you've written about. This chairman of the House Armed Services Committee has had this as one of his pet projects and will presumably be encouraging it with the new administration. Do you think Joe Biden will do that? Or might he take a different approach, one that harkens back to what the House Armed Services Committee in the Clinton administration called erosion by design, which is kind of a similar technique to what was done with this comprehensive test ban business to keep us from doing the testing to modernize our arsenal and put us in the position we've just been discussing?
You know, I don't know what the Biden administration is going to do, but the fact of the matter is that the nuclear triad has had bipartisan support for decades. And I don't quite see the Biden administration kind of getting away from that legacy, given the negative trends in the international environment we've seen to date. You know, the rise of China and the continued belligerence of Russia being some of the more important factors. But I think there might be a question of whether the ground-based strategic deterrent program will be funded and to what extent into the future. Now, should that program be delayed, we might face disarmament by attrition, where we get to the point in 2030 where we just cannot maintain and continue to maintain the Minuteman III system. So, you know, it remains to be seen what happens and whether there are margins to improve the program at a later date. But we know how these things go and how long they take. And so starting off with a delay and lack of funding and lack of necessary support would not be a good sign for the future. Now, it is true that so far that program has had bipartisan support. And so, again, I hope that that will translate into the future.
Yeah, I think it had to be overcome, the objections that is of Adam Smith, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, that bipartisanship only extends so far. We'll see, and you're right, we'll be following it closely. Let me ask you quickly, and we have less than a minute to do this, Michaela Dodge, how do you see the role of missile defense in our nuclear deterrent posture at the moment, and what should it be?
I think missile defense will be a problem because we don't have good successor for the homeland missile defense for the ground-based interceptor. That capability is atrophying, and the Trump administration did not do the sort of the programs much favor by canceling and delaying and kind of taking a lot of time to trying to figure it out and figure out what we'll do. And so that's really where I'm worried when it comes to homeland missile defense, as Iran and North Korea continue to develop their capabilities.
To say nothing of the Russians and Chinese, as we've been talking about.
Yeah, we should have missile defense against Russia and China too, but that at this point, that's just not going to happen in the next administration.
We have to have you back to talk about this further because this is such an important point, and I think the possibilities of doing something from space would address the concerns you've just described. But again, it's going to be a tough sell with the Biden administration, I fear. Let's talk about that in the near future. Thank you, Michaela Dodge, for your time today and for your great expertise and the work you're doing at a really indispensable organization, the National Institute for Public Policy. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope we'll talk very soon and often. Next up, we'll speak with Susan Katz Keating, a national security reporter with Just the News, about what actually went on at the Capitol on the 6th of January. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined by one of the best investigative reporters of our time. And these days, she is doing just that for Just the News, John Solomon's terrific, relatively new news and information platform, with which I'm very pleased to say is a host on Real America's Voice. I have the privilege to be partnered with Just the News. Her name is Susan Katz Keating. She has had a number of positions in various noteworthy American media outlets, including as a military correspondent for, of all things, People magazine, Time magazine, The Washington Times, and her writings have appeared in any number of other publications around the country. She is a good friend of this program, and we're always delighted to have her back. Welcome, Susan. Happy New Year, such as it is.
Happy New Year. Great to be here. Thank you so much. And thank you for the lovely introduction. I appreciate that. Love your work.
Thank you. Let me ask you, Susan, to talk about one of the things that you've been investigating, and I know you're still doing so. And actually, my bet is that you're going to do a better job of the investigation than the Federal Bureau of Investigations is likely to do. But talk to us about what you have come up with so far in terms of trying to figure out what actually took place on the Capitol grounds on the 6th of January and inside the Capitol itself, and at whose hands?
That is the question of the day, isn't it? And what I'm finding overall, I think what we all need to keep in mind is that nothing is ever as it seems at first look, and that there's a whole lot of confusion going on, and there are various factions. There are people who are there with malintent, people who are there, with just innocent intent attending a rally. And then there were also what appears to be predators who just took advantage of the situation for their own purposes. And what I'm hearing and what I'm finding so far is that the rally itself was a political rally, and that people went just wanting to basically get ready for the midterms was what that was all about. What I'm hearing is that they were just trying to make it very, very clear that they believed that, the election was not done properly, and they wanted to voice their concerns. But I'm also told from people who were on scene at the Capitol that there were groups of what they described as Antifa. Of course, no one knows. Antifa doesn't carry around an ID card, but one of my sources told me that he saw these people earlier in the morning down by the Treasury Department, and then he recognized them later carrying geological hammers. Now, that right there tells you that they are planning to smash things. So they use their hammers to break in to the windows. Some of the crowd tried to stop them. And then apparently when the news came in that Pence was going to go ahead to certify the election, that galvanized others in the crowd. So then we suddenly had this massive congealing of different emotions and interests. And there were some who were there as tourists, some who were there to cause trouble. And it's just an absolute, right now, it's the traditional Gordian knot, and you've got to pick through it to unravel it.
Or cut it, as in the ancient mythology it was described was the solution. Let me ask you about one piece of this that I haven't quite gotten a fix on, and that is in getting inside the Capitol, was that something that was a forced entry? I mean, there were broken windows, I guess, in some places, but going through the doors, Susan, have you been able to establish whether the police simply stepped aside and let people in, or whether they were sort of overwhelmed physically and unable to stop the rising tide?
I think that depends on which entrance you were at, because as you know, allowing people into the Capitol to protest, that goes on. I saw that at the Kavanaugh protests. You know, the protesters were allowed in. So in some areas, this was like a normal, okay, you know, these are citizens, let's let them in. And then in other areas, the police were overwhelmed. They were simply outnumbered, and they were not prepared. Weren't prepared for what was coming.
I think that the ground rules that you've experienced in the past, as have I, don't apply at the moment, certainly in the Capitol. I know in a recent appointment I had in the House office building, you had to have somebody who was going to personally escort you up to see a member. So I don't think it's, you know, quite as accessible as it has been. And even in recent years, of course, any tour of the Capitol had to go through the underground visitor center. So I think that they must have had some, you know, encounter with police whose job it was to prevent them from getting in. And I have the feeling, so I'd just be interested in this reporting as you continue to pursue it, whether in really all of the doors they were supposed to not get in and something made it possible for them to do it. But let me turn to another piece of this that I'm also very interested in, Susan, and that is the fact that we have been denied so much information about all of this. In fact, we've been force-fed really a certain narrative, which has now given rise to this extraordinary event of the House of Representatives voting on a bipartisan basis, worse yet, to impeach the president for the second time without a hearing, without much evidence, without really a basis for substantiating this claim that he was personally responsible for these incursions into the Capitol. Give us your thoughts on what's happening in the way of big tech censorship and its implications.
Well, it's terrifying. The number one selling book on Amazon now is 1984, and that's for very good reason. First of all, I believe that Donald Trump terrifies the Democrats because he actually does have a popular base. And it's not because people think that he's, a wild-eyed cowboy. It's because he speaks to things that are very important to the American people, which, you know, like patriotism and
the Constitution, for example.
There is that. Absolutely, there is that. And if you notice, like, he galvanizes his base in a way that no other politician can or has. And I think that's quite frightening to the Democrats because, you know, obviously, you did not see Biden getting this kind of groundswell of support.
Oh, not hardly. In a crowds of handfuls of people honking horns is not quite a Trump rally, for sure.
So the mission is, stop him, like stop him from coming back in 2024, stop the midterms. It's a clumsy Bolshevik style overreach. It's the kind of thing that you would expect to see the Cheka carry out, or, you know, it's the Stalin playbook. And I'm not exaggerating. You silence the opposition, and for big tech to shut down, the opposition voices, it's stunning to me how blatant they are about it and how they just, they're just like, yeah, we're doing it. So what?
Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure in my own mind which is worse, the suppression of alternative viewpoints or the force feeding of sort of the approved narrative. The combination is particularly toxic, and I think you're absolutely right to characterize it to the worst of the, Soviet oppression. But Do you see this as a an organized effort, or is it just individuals in C-suites of these various big tech companies independently deciding that they want to support their team and suppress the Trump one?
That's a great question, Frank. That really is. And I would love to know the answer. But I'm also wondering if it sort of has a de facto, collusion to it, even if they didn't get together in a boardroom and say, let's do this in concert. They have such an agreement, a meeting of the minds in their approach to control and power and oppressive overreach, that it may just be a spontaneous, mutual action on their part, which, again, I don't know because I haven't, documented that. But
a clue, Susan Keating, is what happened to Parler, in which there was clearly a synchronized, concerted effort to take it down by Google, by Amazon, by Apple. And I have the feeling that's kind of a tell on what's been going on more broadly. I was listening to a program yesterday, and I think it was Dan Bongino's, in which he was talking about the fact that the Google chairman had, allowed us how, in connection with some protests that this company was filing with Uganda over their treatment in recent elections, acknowledged, collaborating with peers to arrive at a certain decision. And the suggestion was quite possibly they're doing it in a lot of other places as well. Susan Keating, we're out of time for today, but I so appreciate both the work that you're trying to do to get to the bottom of what we're up against. I have the feeling that you will get there first, far before the FBI and other law enforcement agencies of our government. And we hope you'll come back with updates often in 2021, as it's invaluable. So thank you for the work you do at justthenews.com. Keep it up and stay well in this dangerous 2021. Next up, we'll speak, as promised, with Jeff Nyquist. We'll get his take on some of these characters and what it portends for us that they're at work, not on just the Capitol grounds, but in our country writ large. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a special welcome for the first time in 2021 to the great J.R. Nyquist, one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, and one of the smartest guys I know on the strategic events and challenges of our time. He's an accomplished author, most recently of The Fool and His Enemy, and a blogger par excellence at jrnyquist.blog, and a great guest, and it's always a delight to have him with us. Jeff, Happy New Year to you, such as it is. Welcome back.
Well, Happy New Year. Thank you for having me.
We were just talking with Susan Keating Katz about what actually went down on the Capitol grounds and inside the building on the 6th of January. Jeff, and I know you've been giving it some thought and doing some analysis of some of the individuals who were prominently featured on camera, among other things, making their way into the Capitol building, who did not seem like your run-of-the-mill Trump supporters. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, of course. You had a number of people entering the building, and when the break-in, after the break-in took place in the Capitol, and a group of them, who are sort of, the press has identified them as QAnon supporters, including this QAnon shaman, who's a fellow who sports horns, and you know, he's sort of bare-chested. He's tattooed. He's been identified as Jake Angeli, as one of the names he goes by the Phoenix local Phoenix television. He's a guy that that has been seen at Trump rallies and at Black Lives Matter rallies, which is kind of interesting. And he is supposedly an actor of some kind, which is, you know, funny with politics now, where so much is an act. And of course, other curious characters, you know, there's a character with a tattoo that many people felt was a hammer and sickle on the back of his hand, but I guess it turns out to be a video gaming symbol of some kind. And of course, you have a lot of controversy over whether there were among these QAnon and other Trump supporters, whether there were Antifa in the crowd. Many people saying things. I think a fellow from Utah has been identified as being involved in the break-in part of it. And my friends in Eastern Europe basically signaled me earlier in the week about photographs that has emerged, people in Eastern Europe going over the photographs from the Capitol events, that there was a fellow wanted by the Ukrainian defense minister, or interior ministry, a man named Sergei Dubinin, who has been a Russian operative in Donbass in eastern Ukraine, involved in the separatism there, was seen posing with this Jake Angeli at the Capitol during the events. So that's a big curiosity, yeah.
Our colleague Mike Waller at the Center for Security Policy has recounted in a post that appeared there about his firsthand observations, and he characterizes four different sort of cells that seem to be operating. And we'll have him on to discuss his insights in the days ahead. But Jeff, I think your point is one that leads me to a question that, you know, as a strategically minded guy, I find confounding, and I want your help with this. The thesis, which has now justified in the minds of a majority in the House of Representatives, the impeachment for a second time of Donald Trump, namely that he incited this incursion into the Capitol and all that flowed from it. This doesn't make sense, since Donald Trump, of all people, would have been the one who least wanted any interference in the planned agenda of the day, which was finally to give his side of the story about the evidence that is abundant about the election, well, I call it grand larceny, that took place in the 2020 presidential race. And yet that was the absolutely predictable upshot of any such mayhem unleashed in the Capitol, as that hearing was just getting underway. The opportunity to present the evidence was therefore lost. How do you square that reality with the thesis that Donald Trump actually commissioned this mob of domestic terrorists to engage in violence against the seat of the people's, you know, government?
Well, I think as I'm hearing all this, we're looking at this backwards, because we're immediately thinking about defending what the president did. But the reality is that the Democrats are hysterical. I have never seen such. What we're missing is that these people are no longer in touch with reality. If you're watching this impeachment, if you're watching the press, these are the same people who were saying that, you know, maybe the country needs more riots last summer when they were rioting, you know, when so many people were injured, and I think 30 something people were killed, and there was billions in damage done to buildings by burning. These same people are absolutely hysterical over something that didn't really happen. That is, that their idea that the president incited an attack on the government. I mean, they're basically accusing him of insurrection. Now, if you want to talk about projection, you know, calling Dr. Freud, hello, Dr. Freud, what do you think of this? These people are losing their minds. There's something about the situation in the country that the left is becoming unhinged.
This is really frightening. I'm afraid, Jeff, what you've actually rendered is a clinical observation, not really a hypothesis. So I wouldn't say you're wrong at all. But I want to get, before we run out of time with you, Jeff, to the subject of a very important piece that you posted, I believe, this week about Robert E. Lee, a man whose statue has been disappearing around the country as a result of the riots, for his service as the commanding general of the Army of Northern Virginia in the Civil War, and essentially his insights into what gives rise to civil war-style conflict, and whether that's potentially in our future as a result of these, you know, developments and the unhinged response to them.
Yeah, I've been reading Robert E. Lee's letters, and I'm fascinated by both his reactions before the Civil War began, or as it was beginning, and his reaction to after the war, because he was so level-headed and steady a person. Because he was against the breakup of the Union, very, very much so, and had very strong emotions that the Union should not be dissolved. And yet, you know, he was the great Confederate general, which is something of a puzzle, but it's not if you come to understand his concept of honor. But then at the end of the war, which I think relates to what we're seeing now, he saw that people could become sort of crazy, that they were the public mind or the mind of some section of the public can be not even able to understand reason at all, that there are emotions that people, but, and now I'm saying on both sides, I'm seeing this craziness on the left and this anger on the right. And it's like we're reaching a point where we cannot absorb reason or reasonable analysis anymore, because people are so emotional now. And I don't know if we can, you know, move out of that or not.
It's a perilous time. There's no question about it. And I think what I took away from your essay about some of Lee's letters after, specifically to Jubal Early, another Civil War Confederate general, suggests that there is a real danger that force, if applied to suppress, you know, the desire for and the necessity of, you know, truth-telling, transparency, accountability, and all the rest, can, in fact, conduce to violence, not healing, as we all aspire for. And this is one of the reasons why I think it is so vital, Jeff Nyquist, that we actually see truth-telling, we actually see accountability, we actually see a proper hearing of the evidence that is before us about the grand larceny of the 2020 election. We're going to return to this topic with you, Jeff, very soon. In fact, we'll be talking with you this weekend about it on our television program, Securing America, and we look forward to doing that. Thank you for your time today, my friend, and for your very, very insightful commentary. It's always appreciated. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.